Death of an Expert Witness, Disc 2.
Chapter 6. At 9:10, the mail van stopped outside Sprague's cottage on the outskirts of Chevisham to deliver a single letter. It was addressed to Miss Stella Mawson, Lavender Cottage, Chevisham. But the postman was a local man, and the difference in name caused him no confusion. There had been Sproggs living in the cottage for 4 generations, and the small triangle of green in front of the gate had been Sproggs Green for almost as long. The present owner, having improved the cottage by the addition of a small brick garage and a modern bathroom and kitchen, had decided to celebrate the metamorphosis by planting a lavender hedge and renaming the property. But the villagers regarded the new name as no more than a foreigner's eccentric fancy, which they were under no obligation either to use or to recognise. The lavender hedge, as if in sympathy with their views, failed to survive the first fen winter, and Sprague's cottage remained Sprague's. Angela Foley, the 27-year-old personal secretary to the director of Hoggett's Laboratory, picked up the envelope and guessed at once, by the quality of the paper, the expertly typed address and the London postmark, what it must be. It was a letter they had been expecting. She took it through to the kitchen, where she and her friend were breakfasting, and handed it over without speaking, then watched Stella's face as she read. After a minute she asked, "Well?" "It's what we feared. He can't wait any longer. He wants a quick sale, and there's a friend of his who thinks he might like it for a weekend cottage. As sitting tenants we get first refusal, but he must know by next Monday whether we're interested." She tossed the letter across the table. Angela said bitterly, "Interested? Of course we're interested. He knows we are. We told him weeks ago that we were writing around trying to get a mortgage." "That's just lawyer's jargon. What his solicitor is asking is whether we're able to go ahead. And the answer is that we can't." The arithmetic was plain. Neither of them needed to discuss it. The owner wanted £16,000. None of the mortgage societies they had approached would advance them more than 10. Together they had a little over 2,000 saved, 4,000 short. And with no time left, it might just as well be 40. Angela said, "I suppose you wouldn't take less?" "No. We've tried that. And why should he? It's a fully converted, reed-thatched, 17th-century cottage, and we've improved it. We've made the garden. He'd be a fool to let it go for under 16, even to a sitting tenant." "But, Star, we are sitting tenants. He's got to get us out first." "That's the only reason why he's given us as long as he has. He knows we could make it difficult for him. But I'm not prepared to stay on here under sufferance, knowing that we'd have to go in the end. I couldn't write under those conditions. But we can't find 4,000 in a week, and with things as they are, we couldn't hope for a bank loan, even if I had a book coming out this year, which I haven't. And what I make from writing barely pays my part of the housekeeping. It was tactful of you not to say so." She hadn't been going to say it. Stella wasn't a conveyor belt writer. You couldn't expect her novels to make money. What was it that last reviewer had said? "Fastidious observation wedded to elegantly sensitive and oblique prose." Not surprisingly, Angela could quote all the reviews, even if she sometimes wondered what exactly they were trying to say. Wasn't it she who pasted them with meticulous care into the clippings book which Stella so affected to despise? She watched while her friend began what they both called her tiger prowl, that compulsive pacing up and down, head lowered, hands sunk in her dressing-gown pockets. Then Stella said, "It's a pity that cousin of yours is so disagreeable. Otherwise one might not have minded asking him for a loan. He wouldn't miss it." "But I've already asked him. Not about the cottage, of course. But I've asked him to lend me some money." It was ridiculous that this should be so difficult to say. After all, Edwin was her cousin. She had a right to ask him. And it was her grandmother's money, after all. There was really no reason why Star should be cross. There were times when she didn't mind Star's anger, times even when she deliberately provoked it, waiting with half-shameful excitement for the extraordinary outburst of bitterness and despair, of which she herself was less a victim than a privileged spectator, relishing even more the inevitable remorse and self-incrimination, the sweetness of reconciliation. But now, for the first time, she recognized the chill of fear. When? There was nothing for it now but to go on. Last Tuesday evening. It was after you decided that we'd have to cancel our bookings for Venice next March because of the exchange rate. I wanted it to be a birthday present. Venice, I mean. She had pictured the scene, herself handing over the tickets and the hotel reservations tucked into one of those extra-large birthday cards. Star trying to hide her surprise and pleasure. Both of them poring over maps and guidebooks, planning the itinerary of every marvellous day. To see for the first time and together that incomparable view of San Marco from the western end of the piazza. Star had read to her Ruskin's description, a multitude of pillars and white domes clustered into a long, low pyramid of coloured light. To stand together on the piazzetta in the early morning and look across the shimmering water to San Giorgio Maggiore. It was a dream, as insubstantial as the crumbling city. But the hope of it had been worth steeling herself to ask Edwin for that loan. And what did he say? There was no chance now of softening that brutal negative, of erasing the whole humiliating episode from her memory. He said no. I suppose you told him why you wanted it. It didn't occur to you that we go away from here to be private, that our holidays are our own affair, that it might humiliate me to have Edwin Lorimer know that I can't afford to take you to Venice, even on a 10-day package tour. I didn't! She cried out in vehement protest, horrified to hear the crack in her voice and feel the first hot, gritty tears. It was odd, she thought, that it was she who could cry. Star was the emotional, the vehement one, and yet Star never cried. I didn't tell him anything except that I needed the money. How much? She hesitated, wondering whether to lie, but she never lied to Star. £500. I thought we might as well do it properly. I just told him that I badly needed £500. So, not surprisingly, faced with that irrefutable argument, he declined to hand out. What exactly did he say? Only that Grandmother had made her intentions perfectly plain in her will, that he had no intention of upsetting them. Then I said that most of the money would come to me after his death anyway. I mean, that's what he told me when the will was read. And it would be too late then. I'd be an old lady. I might die first. It was now that was important. But I didn't tell him why I wanted it. I swear that. Swear? Don't be dramatic. You're not in a court of law. And then what did he say? If only Star would stop that agitated pacing, would only turn and look at her, instead of questioning her in that cold, inquisitorial voice. And the new bit was even harder to tell. She couldn't explain to herself why it should be, but it was something that she had tried to put out of her mind for the present anyway. One day she would tell Star, the moment when it was right to tell. She had never imagined being forced into confidence with such brutal suddenness. He said that I shouldn't rely on getting anything in his will. He said that he might acquire new obligations. Obligations was the word he used. And if he did, the will would no longer stand. And now Star swung round and faced her. New obligations. Marriage? Now, that's too ridiculous. Marriage? That desiccated, pedantic, self-satisfied prude? I doubt whether he ever deliberately touches a human body except his own. Solitary, masochistic, Surreptitious vice, that's all he understands. No, not vice, the word's too strong. But marriage, wouldn't you have thought? She broke off. Angela said, he didn't mention marriage. Why should he? But what else would automatically set aside an existing will unless he made a new one? Marriage cancels a will, didn't you know that? You mean that as soon as he married, I should be disinherited? Yes. But that isn't fair. Since when has life been noted for its fairness? It wasn't fair that your grandmother left her fortune to him instead of sharing it with you just because he's a man and she had an old-fashioned prejudice that women shouldn't own money. It isn't fair that you're only a secretary at Hoggart's because no one bothered to educate you for anything else. It isn't fair, come to that, that you should have to support me. I don't support you. In every way except the unimportant one, you support me. It's humiliating to be worth more dead than alive. If my heart gave out tonight, then you'd be all right. You could use the life insurance money to buy the place and stay on. The bank would advance the money once they knew you were my legatee. Without you, I shouldn't want to stay on. Well, if you do have to leave here, at least it will give you an excuse to live on your own, if that's what you want. Angela cried out in vehement protest. I shall never live with anyone else but you. I don't want to live anywhere but here, in this cottage. You know that. It's our home. It was their home. It was the only real home she'd ever known. She didn't need to look around her to fix with startling clarity each familiar loved possession. She could lie in bed at night, and in imagination move confidently around the cottage, touching them in a happy exploration of shared memories and reassurance. The two Victorian lustre plant pots on their matching pedestals found in the lanes at Brighton one summer weekend. The 18th-century oil of Wicken Fen by an artist whose indecipherable signature, peered at through a microscope, had provided so many shared moments of happy conjecture. The French sword in its decorated scabbard, found in a country sale room and now hanging above their fireplace. It wasn't just that their possessions, wood and porcelain, paint and linen, symbolised their joint life. The cottage, their belongings, were their joint life, adorned and gave reality to it, just as the bushes and flowers they had planted in the garden staked out their territory of trust. She had a sudden and terrifying memory of a recurrent nightmare. They were standing facing each other in an empty attic room, bare walls squared with the pale imprints of discarded pictures, floorboards harsh to the feet, two naked strangers in a void, herself trying to reach out her hands to touch Stella's fingers, but unable to lift the heavy, monstrous bolsters of flesh that had become her arms. She shivered, and then was recalled to the reality of the cold autumn morning by the sound of her friend's voice. How much did your grandmother leave? You did tell me, but I've forgotten. About 30,000, I think. And he can't have spent any of it, living with his old father in that pokey cottage. He hasn't even renovated the windmill. His salary alone must be more than enough for the two of them, apart from the old man's pension. Lorimer's a senior scientist, isn't he? What does he get? He's a principal scientific officer. The scale goes up to 8,000. God! More in a year than I could earn from 4 novels. I suppose if he jibbed at 500, he'd hardly part with 4,000. Not at a rate of interest we could afford. But it wouldn't hurt him. I've a good mind to ask him for it after all. Stella was only teasing, of course. But she recognised this, too late to control the panic in her voice. No, please, Star, no, you mustn't. You really hate him, don't you? Not hate. Indifference. I just don't want to be under an obligation to him. Nor, come to that, do I. And you shan't be. Angela went out to the hall and came back pulling on her coat. She said, I'll be late at the lab if I don't hurry. The casserole is in the oven. Try to remember to switch on at 5:30. And don't touch the regulator. I'll turn down the heat when I get back. I think I can just about manage that. I'm taking sandwiches for lunch, so I shan't be back. There's the cold ham and salad in the fridge. Will that be enough, Star? No doubt I'll survive. Yesterday evening's typing is in the folder, but I haven't read it through. How remiss of you. Stella followed her friend out to the hall. At the door, she said, I expect they think at the lab that I exploit you. They know nothing about you at the lab, and I don't care what they think. Is that what Edwin Lorimer thinks, too, that I exploit you? Or what does he think? I don't want to talk about him. She folded her scarf over her blonde hair. In the antique mirror with its frame of carved shells, she saw both their faces distorted by a defect in the glass. The brown and green of Stella's huge luminous eyes smeared like wet paint into the deep clefts between nostrils and mouth, her own wide brow bulging like that of a hydrocephalic child. She said, I wonder what I'd feel if Edwin died this week. A heart attack. A car accident. A brain hemorrhage. Life isn't as convenient as that. Death isn't. Star, shall you reply today to that solicitor? He doesn't expect an answer until Monday. I can phone him at the London office on Monday morning. That's another 5 days. Anything can happen in 5 days.
Chapter 7.
But they're just like mine. The panties, I mean. I've got a pair like that. I bought them from Marks and Spencer's in Cambridge with my first salary check.
It was 10:35, and Brenda Pridmore, at the reception desk at the rear of the main hall of Hoggart's laboratory, watched wide-eyed while Inspector Blakelock drew towards him the first label bag of exhibits from the Clunch Pit murder. She put out a finger and tentatively slid it over the thin plastic, through which the knickers, crumpled and stained around the crotch, were clearly visible. The detective constable who had brought in the exhibits had said that the girl had been to a dance. Funny, thought Brenda, that she hadn't bothered to put on clean underclothes. Perhaps she wasn't fastidious. Or perhaps she had been in too much of a hurry to change. And now the intimate clothes, which she had put on so unthinkingly on the day of her death, would be smoothed out by strange hands, scrutinized under ultraviolet light, perhaps be handed up, neatly docketed, to the judge and jury in the Crown Court. Brenda knew that she would never be again able to wear her own panties, their prettiness contaminated forever by the memory of this dead, unknown girl. Perhaps they had even bought them together in the same store on the same day. She could recall the excitement of spending, for the first time, money she had actually earned. It had been on a Saturday afternoon, and there had been a crush around the lingerie counter, eager hands rummaging among the panties. She had liked the pair with the sprays of pink machine-embroidered flowers across the front. So, too, had this unknown girl. Perhaps their hands had touched. She cried, Inspector, isn't death terrible?
Murder is. Death isn't. At least, no more than birth is. You couldn't have one without the other, or there'd be no room for us all. I reckon I won't worry over much when my time comes.
But that policeman who brought in the exhibits said she was only 18. That's my age.
He was making out the folder for the new case, meticulously transferring details from the police form to the file. And his head, with the cropped dry hair which reminded her so of corn stubble, was bent low over the page so that she could not see his face. Suddenly she remembered being told that he had lost an only daughter, killed by a hit-and-run driver, and she wished the words unsaid. Her face flared, and she turned her eyes away.
But when he replied, his voice was perfectly steady.
"Aye, poor lass. Led him on, I dare say. They never learn. What's that you've got?"
"It's the bag of male clothes. Suit, shoes, and underwear. Do you think these belong to the chief suspect?"
"They'll be the husband's, likely as not."
"But what can they prove? She was strangled, wasn't she?"
"No telling for certain until we get Dr. Kerrison's report. But they usually examine the chief suspect's clothes. There might be a trace of blood, a grain of sand or earth, paint, minute fibres from the victim's clothes, a trace of her saliva even. Or she could have been raped. All that bundle will go into the biology search room with the victim's clothes."
"But the policeman didn't say anything about rape. I thought you said this bundle belonged to the husband."
"You don't want to let it worry you. You have to learn to be like a doctor or a nurse. Detached, isn't it?"
"Is that how forensic scientists feel?"
"Likely as not. It's their job. They don't think about victims or suspects. That's for the police. They're only concerned with scientific facts." He was right, thought Brenda. She remembered the time, only 3 days previously, when the senior scientific officer of the instrument section had let her look into the giant scanning electron microscope and watch the image of a minute pill of putty burst instantaneously into an exotic incandescent flower. He had explained, "It's a coccolith, magnified 6,000 times."
"A what?"
"The skeleton of a microorganism that lived in the ancient seas, from which the chalk in the putty was deposited. They're different, depending on where the chalk was quarried. That's how you can differentiate one sample of putty from another." She had exclaimed,
"But it's so lovely."
He had taken her place at the eyepiece of the instrument. "Yes, nice, isn't it?" But she had known that while she looked back in wonder across a million years, his mind was on the minute scrape of putty from the heel of the suspect's shoe, the trace that might prove a man was a rapist or a murderer. And yet, she had thought, he doesn't really mind. All he cares about is getting the answer right. It would have been no use asking him whether he thought there was a unifying purpose in life, whether it could really be chance that an animal so small that it couldn't be seen by the naked eye could die millions of years ago in the depths of the sea and be resurrected by science to prove a man innocent or guilty. It was odd, she thought, that scientists so often weren't religious when their work revealed a world so variously marvellous and yet so mysteriously unified and at one. Dr. Lorimer seemed to be the only member of Hoggart's who was known to go regularly to church. She wondered if she dared ask him about the coccolith and God. He had been very kind this morning about the murder. He had arrived at the laboratory over an hour late, at 10 o'clock, looking terribly tired, because he had been up that night at the scene of crime, and had come over to the reception desk to collect his personal mail. He had said, "You'll be getting exhibits from your first murder case this morning. Don't let them worry you, Brenda. There's only one death we need to be frightened of, and that's our own." It was a strange thing to have said, an odd way to reassure her. But he was right. She was suddenly glad that Inspector Blakelock had done the documentation on the Clunch Pit murder. Now, with care, the owner of those stained panties would remain, for her, unknown, anonymous, a number in the biology series on a manila folder. Inspector Blakelock's voice broke into her thoughts.
"Have you got those court reports we checked yesterday ready for the mail?"
"Yes, they've been entered in the book."
"I meant to ask you, why do all the court statements have Criminal Justice Act 1967, Sections 2 and 9, printed on them?"
"That's the statutory authority for written evidence to be tendered at committal proceedings in the Crown Court. You can look up the sections in the library. Before the 1967 Act, the labs had a hard time of it, I can tell you. when all scientific evidence had to be given orally. Mind you, the court-going officers still have to spend a fair amount of time attending trials. The defence doesn't always accept the scientific findings. That's a difficult part of the job. Not the analysis, but standing alone in the witness box to defend it under cross-examination. If a man's no good in the box, then all the careful work he does here goes for nothing.
Brenda suddenly remembered something else that Mrs. Mallett had told her, that the motorist who had killed his daughter had been acquitted because the scientist had crumbled under the cross-examination. Something to do with analysis of chips of paint found on the road that matched the suspect's car. It must be terrible to lose an only child. To lose any child. Perhaps that was the worst thing that could happen to a human being. No wonder Inspector Blakelock was often so quiet. That when the police officers came in with their hearty banter, he answered only with that slow, gentle smile. She glanced across at the laboratory clock. 10:45. Any minute now, the scene of crime course would be arriving for their lecture on the collection and preservation of scientific evidence, and this brief spell of quiet would be over. She wondered what Colonel Hoggart would think if he could visit his laboratory now. Her eyes were drawn, as they so often were, to his portrait hanging just outside the director's office. Even from her place at the desk, she could read the gold lettering on the frame. Colonel William Makepeace Hoggart, V.C., Chief Constable, 1894 to 1912. Founder of Hoggart's Forensic Science Laboratory. He was standing in the room that was still used as a library, his ruddy face stern and bewhiskered under the sprouting plumes of his hat, his braided, bemedalled tunic fastened with a row of gilt buttons. One proprietorial hand was laid, light as a priestly blessing, on an old-fashioned microscope in gleaming brass. But the military eyes weren't fixed on this latest scientific wonder. They were fixed on Brenda. Under his accusing gaze, recalled to duty, she bent again to her work.
Chapter 8. By 12 o'clock, the meeting of senior scientists in the director's office to discuss the furniture and equipment for the new laboratory was over, and Howarth rang for his secretary to clear the conference table. He watched her as she emptied and polished the ashtray. He didn't smoke, and the smell of ash offended him. Collected together the copies of the laboratory plans and gathered up the strewn, discarded papers. Even from his desk, Howarth could see Middlemass's complex geometrical doodles and the crumpled agenda ringed with coffee stains of the senior vehicle examiner, Bill Morgan. He watched the girl as she moved with quiet competence about the table, wondering, as always, what, if anything, was going on behind that extraordinarily wide brow, those slanted, enigmatic eyes. He missed his old personal assistant, Marjorie Farraker, more than he had expected. It had, he thought ruefully, been good for his self-conceit to find that her devotion didn't, after all, extend to leaving London, where, surprisingly, she had been discovered to have a life of her own, to join him in the Fens. Like all good secretaries, she had acquired, or at least known how to simulate, some of the idealized attributes of wife, mother, mistress, confidant, servant, and friend, without being, or indeed expecting to be, any of these. She had flattered his self-esteem, protected him from the minor irritations of life, preserved his privacy with a maternal pugnacity, had ensured, with infinite tact, that he knew all he needed to know about what was going on in his laboratory. He couldn't complain about Angela Foley. She was a more than competent shorthand typist and an efficient secretary. Nothing was left undone. It was just that for her he felt that he hardly existed, that his authority, meekly deferred to, was nevertheless a charade. The fact that she was Lorimer's cousin was irrelevant. He had never heard her mention his name. He wondered from time to time what sort of a life she led in that remote cottage with her writer friend, how far it had satisfied her. But she told him nothing, not even about the laboratory.
He knew that Hoggart's had a heartbeat. All institutions did. But the pulse eluded him. He said, "The Foreign and Commonwealth Office wants us to take a Danish biologist for 2 or 3 days next month. He's visiting England to look at the service. Fit him in, will you, when I'm free to give him some time? You'd better consult Dr. Lorimer about his diary commitments. Then let the FCO know what days we can offer." "Yes, Dr. Howarth." At least the autopsy was over. It had been worse than he had expected, but he had seen it through and without disgrace. He hadn't expected that the colours of the human body would be so vivid, so exotically beautiful. Now he saw again Kerrison's gloved fingers, sleek as eels, busying themselves at the body's orifices, explaining, demonstrating, discarding. Presumably he had become as immune to disgust as he obviously was to the sweet, sour smell of his mortuary. And to all the experts in violent death, faced daily with the final disintegration of the personality, pity would be as irrelevant as disgust. Miss Foley was ready to go now, and had come up to the desk to clear his out tray. He said, "Has Inspector Blakelock worked out last month's average turnaround figures yet?" "Yes, sir. The average for all exhibits is down to 12 days, and the blood alcohol has fallen to 1.2 days. But the figure for crimes against the person is up again. I'm just typing the figures now. Let me have them as soon as they're ready, please." There were memories which, he suspected, would be even more insistent than Kerrison marking out with his cartilage knife on the milk-white body the long line of the primary incision. Doyle, that great black bull, grinning at him in the washroom afterward, as side by side they washed their hands. And why, he wondered, had he felt it necessary to wash? His hands hadn't been contaminated. "The performance was well up to standard. Neat, quick and thorough. That's Doc Kerrison. Sorry we shan't be able to call for you when we're ready to make the arrest. Not allowed. You'll have to imagine that bit. But there'll be the trial to attend, with any luck." Angela Foley was standing in front of the desk, looking at him strangely, he thought. "Yes?" "Scobie has had to go home, Dr. Howarth. He's not at all well. He thinks it may be this 2-day flu that's going about, and he says that the incinerator has broken down." "Presumably he telephoned for the mechanic before he left?" "Yes, sir. He says it was all right yesterday morning when Inspector Doyle came with the court orders authorizing the destruction of the cannabis exhibits. It was working then." Howarth was irritated. This was one of those minor administrative details which Miss Faraker would never have dreamed of troubling him with. Miss Foley was, he guessed, expecting him to say something sympathetic about Scobie, to inquire whether the old man had been fit to cycle home. Dr. McIntyre had no doubt bleated like an anxious sheep when any of the staff were ill. He bent his head over his papers. But Miss Foley was at the door. It had to be now. He made himself say, "Ask Dr. Lorimer to come down for a few minutes, will you, please?" He could perfectly casually have asked Lorimer to stay on after the meeting. Why hadn't he? Probably because there might have been an echo of the headmaster in so public a request. Perhaps because this was an interview he had been glad to postpone, even temporarily. Lorimer came in and stood in front of the desk. Howarth took out Bradley's personal file from his right-hand drawer and said, "Sit down, will you, please? This annual report on Bradley, you've given him an adverse marking. Have you told him?" Lorimer remained standing. He said, "I'm required by the reporting rules to tell him. I saw him in my office at 10:30, as soon as I got back from the PM." "Well, it seems a bit hard. According to his file, it's the first adverse report he's had. We took him on probation 18 months ago. Why hasn't he made out?" "I should have thought that was obvious from my detailed markings. He's been promoted above his capacity." "In other words, the board made a mistake?" "That's not so unusual. Boards occasionally do, and not only when it comes to promotions." The allusion was blatant, a deliberate provocation, yet Howarth decided to ignore it. With an effort, he kept his voice level.
"I'm not prepared to countersign this report as it stands. It's too early to judge him fairly. I made that excuse for him last year, when he'd been with us 6 months. But if you disagree with my assessment, you'll probably say so. There's a space provided."
"I intend to use it, and I suggest that you try the effect of giving the boy some support and encouragement. There are two reasons for an inadequate performance. Some people are capable of doing better and will if judiciously kicked into it. Others aren't. To kick them is not only pointless, it destroys what confidence they have. You run an efficient department, but it might be more efficient and happier if you learned how to understand people. Management is largely a matter of personal relationships."
He made himself look up. Lorimer said, through lips so stiff that the words sounded cracked,
"I hadn't realized that your family were noted for success in their personal relationships."
"The fact that you can't take criticism without becoming as personal and spiteful as a neurotic girl is an example of what I mean."
He never knew what Lorimer was about to reply. The door opened and his sister came in. She was dressed in slacks and a sheepskin jacket, her blonde hair bound with a scarf. She looked at them both without embarrassment and said easily,
"Sorry, I didn't realize you were engaged. I ought to have asked Inspector Blakelock to ring."
Without a word, Lorimer, deathly pale, turned on his heels, walked past her, and was gone. Domenica looked after him, smiled, and shrugged. She said, "Sorry if I interrupted something. It's just to say that I'm going to Norwich for a couple of hours to buy some materials. Is there anything you want?"
"Nothing, thank you."
"I'll be back after dinner, but I think I'll give the village concert a miss. Without Claire Easterbrook, the Mozart will be pretty insupportable. Oh, and I'm thinking of going up to London for the best part of next week."
Her brother didn't reply. She looked at him and said,
"What's wrong?"
"How did Lorimer know about Gina?"
He didn't need to ask her if it was she who had told him. Whatever else she may have confided, it would not have been that. She went across, ostensibly to study the Stanley Spencer set in the overmantel of the fireplace, and asked lightly,
"Why?
He didn't mention your divorce, did he?"
"Not directly, but the allusion was intended."
She turned to face him.
"He probably took the trouble to find out as much as possible about you when he knew that you were a candidate for the job here. It isn't such a large service, after all."
"But I came from outside it."
"Well, even so, there would be contacts, gossip. A failed marriage is one of those unconsidered trifles he might expect to sniff out.
And what of it?
After all, it's not unusual. I thought forensic scientists were particularly at risk. All those late hours at scenes of crime, and the unpredictable court attendances. They ought to be used to marital breakups."
He said, knowing that he sounded as petulant as an obstinate child,
"I don't want him in my lab."
"Your lab?
It isn't quite as simple as that, is it?"
"I don't think the Stanley Spencer is right over the fireplace. It looks incongruous. It's strange that Father bought it. Not at all his kind of picture, I should have thought. Did you put it there to shock?"
Miraculously, his anger and misery were assuaged. But then she had always been able to do that for him.
"Merely to disconcert and confuse. It's intended to suggest that I may be a more complex character than they assume."
"Oh, but you are. I've never needed assumption at Cookham to prove it.
Why not the Caruso?
It would look good with that carved over mantle."
"Too pretty."
She laughed and was gone. He picked up Clifford Bradley's report and in the space provided wrote, "Mr. Bradley's performance has been disappointing, but not all the difficulties are of his making. He lacks confidence and would benefit from more active encouragement and support than he has received. I have corrected the final marking to what I consider a more just assessment, and have spoken to the senior biologist about the personnel management in his department. If he did finally decide that, after all, this wasn't the job for him, that snide comment should go some way to ensure that Lorimer stood no chance of succeeding him as director of Hoggart's. Chapter 9. At 1:48 precisely, Paul Middlemas, the document examiner, opened his file on the Clunch Pit murder. The document examination room, which occupied the whole of the front of the building immediately under the roof, smelled like a stationer's shop, a pungent amalgam of paper and ink sharpened by the tang of chemicals. Middlemas breathed it as his native air. He was a tall, rangy, large-featured man, with a mobile, wide-mouthed face of agreeable ugliness, and iron-grey hair that fell in heavy swathes over parchment-coloured skin. Easy-going and seemingly indolent, he was, in fact, a prodigious worker, with an obsession for his job. Paper, in all its manifestations, was his passion. Few men, in or outside the Forensic Science Service, knew so much about it. He handled it with joy and with a kind of reverence, gloated over it, knew its provenance almost by its smell. Identification of the sizing and loading of a specimen by spectrographic or X-ray crystallography merely confirmed what touch and sight had already pronounced. The satisfaction of watching the emergence of an obscure watermark under soft X-rays never palled, and the final pattern was as fascinating to his unsurprised eyes as the expected potter's mark to a collector of porcelain. His father, long dead, had been a dentist, and his son had taken for his own use the old man's inordinately large store of self-designed surgical white coats. They were old-fashioned in cut, waisted and full-skirted as the coat of a Regency buck, and with crested metal buttons fastening high to the side of the throat. Although they were too short in the arm, so that his lean wrists protruded like those of an overgrown schoolboy, he wore them with a certain panache, as if this unorthodox working garb, so different from the regulation white coats of the rest of the laboratory staff, symbolized that unique blend of scientific skill, experience, and flair which distinguishes the good document examiner. He had just finished telephoning his wife, having remembered, rather belatedly, that he was due to help out that evening with the village concert. He liked women, and before his marriage had enjoyed a succession of casual, satisfactory, and uncommitted affairs. He had married late, a buxom research scientist from Cambridge, 20 years his junior, and drove back to their modern flat on the outskirts of the city each night in his Jaguar, his chief extravagance, frequently late, but seldom too late to bear her off to the local pub. Secure in his job, with a growing international reputation, and uxoriously contented with his comely Sophie, he knew himself to be successful and suspected himself to be happy. The document examination laboratory, with its cabinets and range of monorail cameras, took up what some of his colleagues, notably Edwin Lorimer, regarded as more than its share of room. But the laboratory, lit by rows of fluorescent lights and with its low ceiling, was stuffy and ill-ventilated, and this afternoon the central heating, unreliable at the best of times, had concentrated all its efforts on the top of the building. Usually he was oblivious of his working conditions, but a subtropical temperature was difficult to ignore. He opened the door to the passage. Opposite, and a little to the right, were the male and female lavatories, and he could hear the occasional feet, light or heavy, hurried or dilatory, of passing members of staff, and hear the swing of the two doors. The sounds didn't worry him. He applied himself to his task. But the specimen he was now poring over held little mystery. If the crime had been other than murder, he would have left it to his scientific officer assistant, not yet returned from a belated lunch. But murder invariably meant a court appearance and cross-examination. The defence seldom let the scientific evidence go unchallenged in this, the gravest of charges, and a court appearance put document examination in general, and Hoggart's laboratory in particular, on public trial. He made it a matter of principle always to take the murder cases himself. They were seldom the most interesting. What he most enjoyed were the historical investigations, the satisfaction of demonstrating, as he had only last month, that a document dated 1872 was printed on paper containing chemical wood pulp that was first used in 1874, a discovery that had initiated a fascinating unravelling of complicated documentary fraud. There was nothing complicated and little of interest about the present job. Yet, only a few years ago, a man's neck could have depended upon his opinion. He seldom thought of the half-dozen men who had been hanged during the 20 years of his forensic experience, primarily because of his evidence. And when he did, it was not the strained but oddly anonymous faces in the dock which he remembered, or their names, but paper and ink, the thickened downward stroke, the peculiar formation of a letter. Now he spread out on his table the note taken from the dead girl's handbag, placing on each side the two specimens of the husband's handwriting which the police had been able to obtain. One was a letter to the suspect's mother, written on holiday at Southend. How, he wondered, had they managed to extract that from her? The other was a brief telephoned message about a football match. The note taken from the victim's purse was even briefer. "You've got your own chap, so lay off Barry Taylor or you'll be sorry. It would be a pity to spoil a nice face like yours. Acid isn't pretty. Watch it. A well-wisher." The style, he decided, was derived from a recent television thriller. The writing was obviously disguised. It was possible that the police would be able to provide him with some samples of the suspect's handwriting when they visited the lad's place of work. But he didn't really need them. The similarities between the threatening note and the samples were unmistakable. The writer had tried to alter the slant of his hand and had changed the shape of the small R. But the lifts of the pen came regularly at every fourth letter. Middlemas had never yet found a forger who remembered to vary the interval at which he lifted pen from paper, and the dot above the I, high and slightly to the left, and the over-emphatic apostrophe were almost a trademark. He would analyse the paper sample, photograph and enlarge each individual letter, and then mount them on a comparison chart, and the jury would pass it solemnly from hand to hand, and wonder why it needed a highly paid expert to come and explain what anyone could see with his own eyes. The telephone rang. Middlemas stretched out a long arm and held the instrument to his left ear. Susan Bradley's voice, at first apologetic, then conspiratorial, and finally close to tears, squeaked into his ear in a long monologue of complaint and desperation. He listened, made soft, encouraging noises, held the receiver an inch or two from his ear, and meanwhile noted that the writer, poor bastard, hadn't even thought of altering the distinctive crossbar of his small letter T. Not that it would have done him any good. And he couldn't have known, poor devil, that his effort would feature as an exhibit in his trial for murder. "All right," he said, "don't worry. Leave it to me." "And you won't let him know I phoned you?" "Of course not, Susan. Relax. I'll settle it." The voice crackled on. "Then tell him not to be a fool, for God's sake. Hasn't he noticed that we've got 1.5 million unemployed? Lorimer can't sack him. Tell Clifford to hang on to his job and stop being a bloody fool. I'll deal with Lorimer." He replaced the receiver. He had liked Susan Moffat, who for 2 years had worked for him as his S.O. She had both more brains and more guts than her husband, and he had wondered, without greatly caring, why she had married Bradley. Pity, probably, and an overdeveloped maternal instinct. There were some women who simply had to take the unfortunate, literally, to their breast. Or perhaps it was just lack of choice, the need for a home of her own and a child. Well, it was too late to try and stop the marriage now, and it certainly hadn't occurred to him to try at the time. And at least she had the home and the kid. She had brought the baby to the lab to see him only a fortnight ago. The visit of the prune-faced, yelling bundle had done nothing to change his own resolution not to produce a child. But certainly Susan herself had seemed happy enough, and she would probably be happy again if something could be done about Lorimer. He thought that the time had, perhaps, come to do something about Lorimer. And he had, after all, his own private reason for taking on the job. It was a small personal obligation, and to date it hadn't particularly fretted what he supposed other people called conscience. But Susan Bradley's call had reminded him. He listened. The footsteps were familiar. Well, it was a coincidence, but better now than later. Moving to the door, he called at the retreating back, "Lorimer, I want a word with you." Lorimer came and stood inside the door, tall, unsmiling, in his carefully buttoned white coat, and regarded Middlemas with his dark, wary eyes. Middlemas made himself look into them, and then turned his glance away. The irises had seemed to dilate into black pools of despair. It was not an emotion he felt competent to deal with, and he felt discomforted. What on earth was eating the poor devil? He said, carefully casual, "Look, Lorimer, lay off Bradley, will you? I know he's not exactly God's gift to forensic science, but he's a conscientious plodder, and you're not going to stimulate either his brain or his speed by bullying the poor little beast. So cut it out." "Are you telling me how to manage my staff?" Lorimer's voice was perfectly controlled, but the pulse at the side of his temple had begun to beat visibly. Middlemas found it difficult not to fix his eyes on it. "That's right, mate. This member of your staff, anyway. I know damn well what you're up to, and I don't like it. So stow it." "Is this meant to be some kind of a threat?" "More a friendly warning. Reasonably friendly, anyway. I don't pretend to like you, and I wouldn't have served under you if the Home Office had been daft enough to appoint you director of this lab. But I admit that what you do in your own department isn't normally my business, only this happens to be an exception. I know what's going on, I don't like it, and I'm making it my business to see that it stops." "I didn't realise that you had this tender regard for Bradley. But of course Susan Bradley must have phoned you. He wouldn't have the guts to speak for himself. Did she telephone you, Middlemas?" Middlemas ignored the question. He said, "I haven't any particular regard for Bradley, but I did have a certain regard for Peter Ennals, if you can remember him. Ennals drowned himself because his fiancée threw him over, and he'd had a mental breakdown. He left a note explaining his action, and it was read out at the inquest. Both things happened months after he left the Southern Laboratory. Neither had anything to do with me." "What happened while he was at the lab had a hell of a lot to do with you. He was a pleasant, rather ordinary lad with two good A-levels and an unaccountable wish to become a forensic biologist when he had the bad luck to begin work under you. As it happens, he was my wife's cousin. I was the one who recommended him to try for the job, so I have a certain interest. You could say a certain responsibility." Lorimer said, "He never said that he was related to your wife. But I can't see what difference it makes. He was totally unsuited for the job. A forensic biologist who can't work accurately under pressure is no use to me or the service, and he'd better get out. We've no room for passengers. That's what I propose to tell Bradley."
"Then you'd better have second thoughts."
"And how are you going to make me?"
It was extraordinary that lips so tight could produce any sound, that Lorimer's voice, high and distorted, could have forced itself through the vocal cords without splitting them.
I shall make it plain to Howarth that you and I can't serve in the same lab. He won't exactly welcome that. Trouble between senior staff is the last complication he wants just now. So he'll suggest to Establishment Department that one of us gets a transfer before we have the added complication of moving into a new lab. I'm banking on Howarth, and his stabs come to that, concluding that it's easier to find a forensic biologist than a document examiner.
Middlemas surprised himself. None of this rigmarole had occurred to him before he spoke. Not that it was unreasonable. There wasn't another document examiner of his calibre in the service, and Howarth knew it. If he categorically refused to work in the same laboratory as Lorimer, one of them would have to go. The quarrel wouldn't do either of them any good with the Establishment Department, but he thought he knew which one it would harm most.
Lorimer said, "You helped stop me getting the directorship. Now you want to drive me out of the lab."
"Personally, I don't care a damn whether you're here or not. But just lay off bullying Bradley."
"If I were prepared to take advice about the way I run my department from anyone, it wouldn't be a third-rate paper fetishist with a second-rate degree who doesn't know the difference between scientific proof and intuition."
The taunt was too absurd to puncture Middlemas's secure self-esteem, but at least it warranted a retort. He found that he was getting angry. And suddenly he saw light. He said,
"Look, mate, if you can't make it in bed, if she isn't finding you quite up to the mark, don't take your frustration out on the rest of us. Remember Chesterfield's advice. The expense is exorbitant, the position ridiculous, and the pleasure transitory."
The result astounded him. Lorimer gave a strangled cry and lunged out. Middlemas's reaction was both instinctive and deeply satisfying. He shot out his right arm and landed a punch on Lorimer's nose. There was a second's astonished silence in which the two men regarded each other. Then the blood spurted, and Lorimer tottered and fell forward. Middlemas caught him by the shoulders and felt the weight of his head against his chest. He thought, "My God, he's going to faint." He was aware of a tangle of emotion. Surprise at himself, boyish gratification, pity, and an impulse to laugh. He said, "Are you all right?" Lorimer tore himself from his grasp and stood upright. He fumbled for his handkerchief and held it to his nose. The red stain grew. Looking down, Middlemas saw Lorimer's blood spreading on his white coat, decorative as a rose. He said,
"Since we're engaging in histrionics, I believe your response ought now to be, 'By God, you swine, you'll pay for this.'"
He was astounded by the sudden blaze of hate in the black eyes. Lorimer's voice came to him, muffled by the handkerchief.
"You will pay for it."
And then he was gone. Middlemas was suddenly aware of Mrs. Bidwell, the laboratory cleaner, standing by the door, eyes large and excited behind her ridiculous, upswept Diamante spectacles.
"Nice goings-on, I don't think. Senior staff fighting each other. You ought to be ashamed of yourselves."
"Oh, we are, Mrs. Bidwell. We are." Slowly Middlemas eased his long arms from his coat. He handed it to her. "Drop this in the soiled linen, will you?"
"Now you know very well, Mr. Middlemas, that I don't go into the gents' cloakroom, not in working hours. You put it in the basket yourself. And if you want a clean one now, you know where to find it. I'm putting out no more clean linen until tomorrow." "Fighting, indeed. I might have known that Dr. Lorimer would be mixed up in it. But he's not a gentleman you'd expect to find using his fists. Wouldn't have the guts, that would be my view. But he's been odd in his manner these last few weeks, no doubt about that. You heard about that spot of bother in the front hall yesterday, I suppose? He practically pushed those kids of Dr. Kerrison's out the door. All they were doing was waiting for their dad." No harm in that, I suppose. There's a very nasty atmosphere in this lab recently, and if a certain gentleman doesn't take hold of himself, there'll be mischief done. You mark my words.
Chapter 10. It was nearly 5 o'clock and dark before Detective Inspector Doyle got back to his home in the village 4 miles to the north of Cambridge. He had tried to telephone his wife once, but without success. The line was engaged. Another of her interminable, secretive and expensive telephone calls to one of her old nursing friends, he thought, and duty satisfied, he made no further attempt. The wrought-iron gate, as usual, was open, and he parked in front of the house. It wasn't worth garaging the car for a couple of hours, which was all the time he could allow himself. Scoop House hardly looked its best in the late afternoon of a dark November evening. No wonder that the agents hadn't recently sent anyone to view. It was a bad time of the year. The house was, he thought, a monument to miscalculation. He had bought it for less than 17,000, and had spent 5,000 on it to date, expecting to sell it for at least 40. But that was before the recession had upset the calculations of more expert speculators than he. Now, with the property market sluggish, there was nothing to do but wait. He could afford to hang on to the house until the market quickened. He wasn't sure that he would be given a chance to hold on to his wife. He wasn't even sure that he wanted to. The marriage, too, had been a miscalculation, but given the circumstances of the time, an understandable one. He wasted no time on regrets. The two tall oblongs of light from the first-floor drawing-room window should have been a welcoming promise of warmth and comfort. Instead, they were vaguely menacing. Maureen was at home. But where else, she would have argued, was there for her to go in this dreary East Anglian village on a dull November evening? She had finished tea, and the tray was still at her side. The milk bottle with its crushed top pressed back, a single mug, sliced bread spilling out of its wrapper, a slab of butter on a greasy dish, a bought fruitcake in its unopened carton. He felt the customary surge of irritation, but said nothing. Once, when he had remonstrated at her sluttishness, she had shrugged. "Who sees? Who cares?" He saw, and he cared. But it had been many months since he had counted with her. He said, "I'm taking a couple of hours' nap. Wake me at 7, will you?"
"You mean we aren't going to the Chevisham concert?"
"For God's sake, Maureen, you were yelling yesterday that you couldn't be bothered with it. Kids' stuff, remember?"
"It's not exactly the talk of the town, but at least we were going out. Out of this dump. Together for a change. It was something to dress up for. And you said we'd have dinner afterwards at the Chinese restaurant at Ely."
"Sorry. I couldn't know I'd be in a murder case."
"When will you be back? If there's any point in asking."
"God knows. I'm picking up Sergeant Beale. There are still one or two people we've got to see who are at the Muddington dance, notably a lad called Barry Taylor. There was some explaining to do. Depending on what we get out of him, I may want to drop in on the husband again."
"That'll please you, won't it? Keeping him in a muck sweat. Is that why you become a cop? Because you like frightening people?"
"That's about as stupid as say you become a nurse because you get a kick out of emptying bedpans." He flung himself in a chair and closed his eyes, giving way to sleep. He saw again the boy's terrified face, smelled again the sweat of fear. But he'd stood up well to that first interview, hindered rather than helped by the presence of his solicitor, who had never seen his client before, and had made it painfully apparent that he would prefer never to see him again. He had stuck to his story that they'd quarrelled at the dance and he had left early, that she hadn't arrived home by 1 o'clock, that he'd gone out to look for her on the road and across the Clunch Pit field, returning alone 1/2 an hour later, that he'd seen no one
and hadn't been anywhere near the clutch pit or the derelict car. It was a good story. Simple, unelaborated, possibly even true, except in that one essential. But with luck, the lab report on her blood and the stain on his jacket cuff, the minute traces of sandy soil and dust from the car on his shoes, would be ready by Friday. If Lorimer worked late tonight, and he usually did, the blood analysis might even be available by tomorrow. And then would come the elaborations, the inconsistencies, and finally the truth. She said, "Who else was at the scene?" It was something, he thought, that she had bothered to ask. He said sleepily, "Lorimer, of course. He never misses a murder scene. He doesn't trust any of us to know our jobs, I suppose. We had the usual half-hour hanging about for Kerrison. That maddened Lorimer, of course. He's done all the work at the scene, all anyone can do. And then he has to cool his heels with the rest of us, waiting for God's gift to forensic pathology to come screaming up with a police escort and break the news to us that what we all thought was a corpse is, surprise, surprise, indeed a corpse, and that we can safely move the body. The forensic pathologist does more than that. Of course he does, but not all that much more, not at the actual scene. His job comes later." He added, "Sorry I couldn't call. I did try, but you were engaged." "I expect that was Daddy. His offer still stands, the job of security officer in the organisation. But he can't wait much longer. If you don't accept by the end of the month, then he'll advertise." Oh, God, he thought, not that again. "I wish your dear Daddy wouldn't talk about the organisation. It makes the family business sound like the mafia. If it were, I might be tempted to join. What Daddy's got are 3 cheap, shabby shops, selling cheap, shabby suits to cheap, shabby fools who wouldn't recognise a decent cloth if it were shoved down their throats. I might have considered coming into the business if dear Daddy hadn't already got Big Brother as a co-director, ready to take over from him, and if he didn't make it so plain that he only tolerates me because I'm your husband. But I'm damned if I'm going to fart around like a pansy floorwalker, watching that no poor sod nicks the wife fronts, even if I am dignified with the name security officer. I'm staying here." "Where you've got such useful contacts." And what exactly, he wondered, did she mean by that? He'd been careful not to tell her anything, but she wasn't altogether a fool. She could have guessed. He said, "Where I've got a job. You knew what you were taking on when you married me." But no one ever does know that, he thought. Not really. "Don't expect me to be here when you get back." That was an old threat. He said easily, "Suit yourself. But if you're thinking of driving, forget it. I'm taking the Cortina. The clutch is playing up on the Renault. So if you're planning on running home to Mummy before tomorrow morning, you'll have to phone Daddy to call for you, or take a taxi." She was speaking, but her voice, peevishly insistent, was coming from far away, no longer coherent words, but waves of sound beating against his brain. 2 hours. Whether or not she bothered to rouse him, he knew that he would wake almost to the minute. He closed his eyes and slept.
This ends Disc 2.